to Aspen, interviewing Natalie Janu on September 16th, 1986. Natalie, when did you first come to Aspen?
I arrived in Aspen on Armistice Day, when it was November 11th in 1948.
48 in November, so the first lift...
First lift was 2 years old, I suppose, and they had just finished Ruthie's Run, and they had just finished building, or only a year before, I think, building the second part of lift number one or lift number two.
Right, because when they had dedicated the lift in 1947, it was only the first half of the single lift.
Yeah.
And so where did you come from, and why did you choose Aspen?
That's a story that has very little to do with skiing. My cousin had found her way here by way of Santa Fe with friends who were hooked on Aspen. I'd been living with her in New York, sharing a house or an apartment. And my aunt asked me to come back out here with her to collect her dolls and dishes and make sure that she got back to New York instead of staying out in the West. She was a commercial artist.
Living here in Aspen?
She was just temporarily, she was just visiting here in Aspen. And so I came out and I made sure that she went back, but I stayed.
Great. Well, what was it?
My first day or two in Aspen, I was a guest of a girl whose last name, I believe, was Duke.
Molly Duke?
No, not Molly. It was Jane Duke,
Duke,
who operated a little gift store for that in the Hotel Jerome that belonged to Ruthie Brown and or Ruthie Humphreys, and we lived in the Pink House, which was Ruthie's house.
Right. Mm-hmm. Great. And so, what was your first job? How did you exist here?
Well, exist is about what it was for the first little while. My cousin and I rented the old assay office, which belonged to Mrs. Shaw, and did some fixing up and stuff in lieu of paying rent, and we were experimenting with her artistic ability in trying to do hand-painted scarves for skiers that would not lose their color when you laundered them. And we did discover, my job was sort of the chemistry department and she was the artiste. And we did succeed in making a formula, but then I went skiing and broke my leg, and that was the end of that.
Was that first winter?
That was that first winter.
40.
I was not a skier. I mean,
40.
I was 40. It was what, February 2nd, 1949, when I broke my leg.
Yeah, because you came in the fall.
I'm probably the only person who ever shushed the snowball with very little skiing experience and lived to talk about it. I did not know how to turn.
Oh. Oh, dear.
It was my first trip down the mountain. Somebody talked me into going up and skiing down.
Without any ski lessons, oh dear.
Yeah, without knowing what I was doing very much.
So, what do you mean that was the end of that? You didn't leave Aspen, of course.
I left Aspen and went to Arizona to visit with my father until I was able to perambulate. I was down there for about 3 months. I came back, I got off the bus, and Pepe Teichner said, "Natalie, you type, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, will you work for me on the Goethe Festival reservations?" And I said, "Well, I would, Pepe, but it's time that I faced reality, and I think probably I better pack up my dolls and dishes and go over to Denver or someplace where I can get a real job." And he said, "Well, while you're packing, go to work for me." So I went to work for him supposedly part-time, which quickly worked into full-time. And then when the Goethe thing was over, I went to work was hired by the Hotel Jerome as a desk clerk to work on their reservation.
Tell us a little about the Goethe Festival. It was in the summer of 49.
Summer of 49.
And so you helped with the reservation.
And made the awful mistake of seating Rocky Cooper accidentally and inadvertently behind a post in the tent, which had to be very quickly changed.
Oh dear. So you had a little to do with the protocol situation.
Well, we didn't know where the things were really. Till the tent was finally up and Pop Hauser and, you know, had functioned, we got down there and found that we had seated her behind a tent. One of the tent poles. So.
That was the first year the tent was up.
That's right.
Used.
Yeah, the tent was built for that. It was put up originally for that thingy.
And then they did have some music, but they brought it in from Minneapolis.
They had, I can't remember.
The conductor.
Yeah.
Matt Paul. Yes.
And he brought his own piano.
Oh.
He wouldn't. What was his name?
I see his picture. I can see his picture in the museum.
Yeah, well, I can see him. I had him transportation-wise and every other which way, because he came here a couple of years.
Maybe I'll dub that in later. Yeah. Anyway, so 40 years, you got through the summer of 49, and as you say, then you just got used to living here, and then all of a sudden you were working at the Hotel Jerome.
I was working at the Hotel Jerome as a desk clerk, and we were about headed into the FIS.
Oh, that's right, 49-50 then.
49-50. January of 50 or...
No, it was in February of 50, yeah.
Well, January they started arriving and rehearsing.
And training, yeah.
And training, yeah. Rehearsing, training.
Sorry, you rehearse in the summer and train in the winter. Or all year round. Anyway, so that was an exciting time for Aspen.
Yes.
The 1950 FIS.
Yeah.
1950 FIS.
Yeah.
Who were some of the skiers and racers that you met during that time? Do you remember?
Not really. Not really. I'm trying to think of the... all I can remember now is Tony Seiler, which was way later.
Yeah. Well, of course, Zeno Cola was here.
Zeno Cola was the one who won it, and he's the name I was trying to remember.
Yeah. And I think Stein Erickson was here at that time.
Oh, yeah.
He
was here, definitely.
Here.
Yeah,
and his brother.
And of course, he's so much of a fixture in Aspen, you know, mm-hmm. later on. I was always surprised when he came back.
And who were some of the ski school instructors your first 2 years here?
Oh, Klaus Obermeier was the... He was a ski instructor. And...
of course, head of the ski school was...
Friedel and Fred.
Yeah.
Were head of the ski school. And Ed Lynch was a ski instructor. And Maury Shepherd,
right.
Was a ski instructor. Pete Seibert
was here, they were all here in the early days.
I don't know when Jack McTarnahan came. Mm-hmm. I don't remember him. See, I was not a skier, so they were just, you know, you knew them in the... Steve Knowlton.
Yeah, well, he was more here for racing, and then he started his Golden Horn.
Yeah, but he was a ski instructor, too, for a while before he got involved with the sports shop.
Mm-hmm.
Golden Horn, and of course those the early days in the Golden Horn were marvelous. Shady Lane.
Mm-hmm. Did the hotel provide you then with your own room and you lived?
The first 18 months I was in Aspen, I believe I moved 18 times. From one unoccupied hotel room to another. Well, originally, if you count staying at the Pink House, and then we got a room in the Prince Albert, and then I moved in with some other gals, I'm not sure whether Ann Davis was in that group or not, in a house up on, just opposite Little Nell, that belonged to Henry Beck, which promptly burned down when I was in there for about a week before we managed to burn it down.
Why? Did you save any of your belongings? At least
no.
Got yourself out.
Got myself out and went back and found the little case that had the few precious items that I owned that had been just tossed out of the upstairs bedroom into a snowbank. I went back 3-4 times digging and crawling around and did finally find it.
Oh, well, was this in the summer or the winter?
In the winter. It was in January.
Now, was this
just shortly after. This was in
49.
It was in January of 49. Mm-hmm.
The first year you were
the
here.
The first year. I'd been here just a few months. Then moved back into the Prince Albert. As a matter of fact, I rung an extra Prince Albert in there because I moved right from the penthouse in with these people.
And then you said for some reason you became skier of the week, or is this after you...
This was as a contributor to the ski program after the Jeep lift.
Okay, so that's, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
Try to go chronologically. Okay,
yeah.
After your Hotel Jerome job, that was sort of seasonal then.
Then I got the idea that, no, that was year-round. And I talked to Chuck Bishop, and I wanted to run the sports desk on a percentage basis. And, you know, sell lift tickets and be a Main Street office for side street businesses. And he said, well, it's a very good idea, but Meg and Bill Bronski already have that job, and they didn't work in the summertime at that point. They were just selling lift tickets in the winter, I think. And you're much too valuable where you are. This is behind the front desk. Well, I was bored silly with the front desk. And icing the thermostats to bring the heat up for people who were too cold in their rooms. And they were all locked, so they couldn't turn it up automatically. So we used to put lights on. Cool them down so they'd bring the heat up in the hotel. Anyway. So then I quit that spring, and I started The Little Percent, which was in, well, it's now the, well, it was The Wheel of a Wash. It also belonged to Mrs. Shaw.
For those who may not know, Little Percent was a taxi service, right?
Well, later on, but when I started it, I bought the name from Sam Howell, who had called it a little, he had a little gift shop, lending library, and what all in the hotel under the stairs. And I bought the name from him for $1 and all other good and valuable consideration, just to make it legal, because he had been an entity. And my idea was to be a Main Street office for side street businesses and get people to come in, and the big gimmick was to help them get train reservations to and from Glenwood Springs and Denver. And also we'd make one or two long distance calls. Got a.
So you were almost one of the first travel services here.
Yeah. And later became Island Travel Service, or became a Main Street office for Island Travel Service. Fred was really only interested in the big grand overseas trips in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And we did all the nitty gritty stuff and got the commission from the little bitty stuff, and he made his big tours and paid for his own trips to Europe and got the major part of the commission from the big stuff. So that was fine, because there's no way that I could have done or was interested in doing any of the big stuff. But among the things that I represented was the quotes Aspen Taxi, which never had any cars available. And it was a case of, if you don't like the way they run the railroad, build your own. I finally bought his franchises because I was much so interested in the sightseeing business, and most particularly in the summer Jeep trips. That was my big forte. I got involved in that.
When was the, so were there there weren't any cars then that you bought from the business.
I bought an old wooden bodied station wagon from the gentleman who owned the taxi service.
Oh, so there was a taxi service.
There was a taxi service here. He had gotten his PUC license through Walter Pepke, who'd been very instrumental in getting it out of Denver. But he didn't, his son had always gone out with the cars and they were always broken down. You couldn't get anybody to do anything. He didn't, it was awful, but the permits existed. And he had two cars. One was an old wooden bodied station wagon and the other one was a brown DeSoto limousine with jump seats. It had two front seats and then yep. jump seats in the way back, which were mostly in the baggage compartment. It was terrible.
Yep.
Terrible car. And
did they use that during the Goethe Festival? How did they get people back and forth, or did they just walk?
They did their own thing. I don't know. The first August that I owned it, this was a real landmark. I had it in the winter and in the summer. And then in the month of August in 19... I bought it in 40, let's see, 49, 50. I bought it in 50. I bought the franchises from him, or rather I bought the two vehicles from him, and then mortgaged them for enough to buy the franchises. And that first, August that I owned it, I bought it from him in September of 1950. I started on my own in the spring of 1950. Am I in the right year? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That following August, I made as much in the 1 month of August as he had made in the whole preceding year to the time that I bought it. So that was a landmark.
Right.
Because it was really penny ante that the to start with was terribly penny-ante and real hard to get going, and then it really took off like crazy. And as long as it was small enough and the town was small enough so that you could do it pretty much yourself with the assistance of a few kids like Neil Beck and his cousin, Paul.
Mm-hmm. They were drivers for you?
They were drivers for me that first year.
Were they also mechanics? That's most important.
Roustabouts. I mean, the change of tire and like that, but the mechanical work was done pretty much by Harold Motors and my pet, Martin Bishop. And I, after he left Aspen, went back to Denver, and I got a little bigger and had more cars and could manage to do it. I hired him back and moved him. He came back to Aspen.
I was going to say, I don't remember him staying down in Denver. Yeah.
And well, he was over there for, I don't know, 3-4 years, but I persuaded him to come back and built a little garage for him and so he could take care of my taxi cab. But early on, it was just hope that you could keep them running one way or another. Little stuff I could do myself, but anything I didn't understand very
much. So how long did you have the Little Percent taxi service? And how many cars did they end up with in taxi?
Well, I've kind of forgotten, but and the Little Percent, I started it in the spring of 1950, and I sold it in December. I quit operating on the 14th of December, 1962. And at that time, I had 12 vehicles that were associated with the taxi service. Three of them were Jeeps. Five were limousines. Two were Jeeps at that point, I think. I don't know.
Well, anyway.
Yeah, two or three. And then I had the little checker cabs.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I had two of the checkers. Mm-hmm. Then I went, then I also had Hertz Rent-A-Car, and I owned 12 relatively up-to-date Chevrolet sedans.
Where was your office then? Did you still have it on Main Street? Or?
No.
You moved to?
No, I built in 51 or 52. I built the little place that is between the Golden Horn and there was a bus station there. Now it would be on the mall.
Right, it'd be
right across from Dr. Baxter's, Barnard Baxter's office.
Right, I think there's a t-shirt shop there.
Yeah.
And between them.
And the little tiny building has been very much enlarged. We had a little garden at the side, and the taxi drivers and I used to have dinners out there in the summertime, and on a picnic table, and it was very pleasant considering that I lived behind the office for a good many years, 13 years I think it was.
So from a
12 years.
Mm-hmm. Being a woman business, and you ended up hiring them. What was your
The last year that I had the taxi business, and I think one of the things that drove me out of the taxi business was that I had to fill out 54 withholding forms for transient drivers who tried to stay open for 3 shifts a day, and you had to keep all the cars on the road, and you had a whole different crew in the winter than you had in the summertime. The whole business.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the Jeep lift, which was in 1954?
That's what I'm thinking. Yes. It's in one of those, it's Dateline on one of those articles.
This is exactly what happened to the lift that made us, and what lift was it?
Well, it was the number one lift. It was the one that took off from downtown. And I don't know, I'm not enough of a mechanic to really know what happened, but the main bull wheel, I guess, broke a cog or broke a tooth in the that kept it going. I ought to read that magazine article to find out what it was that happened. But anyway, originally they thought it would only be down for a couple of hours, and then they discovered what was wrong, and they had to get the part out from Denver, and it couldn't be flown in, and it had to come over by truck. And when they could get it, I think what happened, they had to take the bull wheel over there and have it repaired and then bring it back. And this wound up being, was it a grand total of 5 days, I think, that the lift was down and everybody was leaving town like crazy. And said, well, maybe we can get everybody to use their Jeeps. Red Roland went up and opened up the back road to the sun deck. And
no, he plowed it out.
He plowed it out, yeah. And we used everything that we could find, got all kinds of, everybody who had a four-wheel drive vehicle, practically. I think there were 35 or 36 Jeeps finally that got involved.
Great.
We made 5 round trips a day, but we had to do it in convoy fashion. They all had to
leave.
It was only a one-way road.
Somebody had to organize it a little bit.
Well, that was
so
much,
once they
that,
got
that,
up
that
there, they could ski the top part and use number 2 lift, and number 3 lift was in by then, wasn't it?
No.
It was not.
No, there was
only number 2.
What happened, we were taking, people were coming. I think we
54.
Were taking the same people up 5 different times. They were skiing all the way down to the bottom. I'm not sure. I don't think the second half of the lift was running either.
Well, in those days, there wasn't much. There was only one trail to it, too. I mean, as there is now.
Anyway, we were meeting them at the bottom of Little Nell and loading up the bathtub, the sob, as we used to call it, which was a sawed-off laundry truck. With as many people as we could get in, standing up, and holding their skis, and anything else that was available. A T-Lazy 7 had their big old cattle truck down there, and they loaded that up, and we'd shuttle the people out to the bottom of the Little Annie Road, to the Midnight Mine Road, and load them into the Jeeps, take them to the top of the mountain, and the first Jeep up had to wait for the last Jeep to get up because they couldn't turn around and come back. They would come back down to the bottom, and by that time we'd have another load ready to go. And people were making 5 round trips.
Were the tourists happy about it? Were they delighted? No doubt.
We got some pretty good publicity, and I can attest to this just simply because in the middle of the night, the third day of the Jeep lift, I went to Glenwood Springs to take some people down to the train, and I picked up a gentleman who got off the train and wanted to go to Aspen. And on the way up, I said, "How come you're going to Aspen? Don't you know that the lift is broken down?" And he said, "Oh, yes, but they've got this marvelous Jeep lift going, and I want to get in on that."
So, and Charlie knew eventually. And so did they charge for this?
We shook a donation box as people were getting into the trucks and the buses, or the trucks is what it amounted to. I guess that stopped because right is the bus.
Yeah.
Not the Jeeps.
Oh.
It was here in town that we shook a donation box at them and suggested that they could pay $1. And that just barely covered the expenses of oil and gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
We had to take a compressed air tank and gasoline cans and everything out from town for the Jeeps as they would run out. And some of them, I remember Jenny Chamberlain blew the engine on her carry-all Jeep. Almost, I mean, it just sort of ran out of oil and there was lots of blue smoke and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It was kind of a bad scene. Most of the people were very good. They footed their own bills. We tried to get a donation from the Ski Corporation or something later, but they were too busy repairing the lift with their money. They turned us down. We had hoped to reimburse some of the people who had real problems with their Jeeps because of over straining them.
Yeah. Sure. Well, who else helped out besides Jenny Chamberlain, Jenny Horn, her partner of the Prospector?
Just about anybody who had a Jeep at any time to drive it.
Because what other lodges? Was it Norway Lodge here then, yes?
No, I don't think it wasn't. It was mostly, you know, friends, Romans, and countrymen. Wasn't necessarily lodge owners.
Mm-hmm.
I really can't remember who all did it. Of course, Paul Worth had his own vehicle. No, was Paul up there then? No, Howard Ory was up there then.
Was he running a Sundeck then, or Howard Ory?
Howard Ory was, I think. I think they lived up there.
Mm-hmm.
Howard and Jean Ory. I don't remember. I remember Jenny Chamberlain because I remember that her Jeep blew up.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the Jeeps were just open Jeeps, didn't have tops on, I think, because you could get more people in if you didn't have a top on.
Sure. Well, then you had the skis stuck up.
Yeah, that's right.
The open top
stuck again. Up every which way.
Yeah.
Like,
and the weather held out. There wasn't any stormy days. And
not that I recall. Of course, what was going on? I was down at the bottom, running around like crazy, trying to make sure that gasoline and air tanks and everything else went out on the next trip, and making sure that I was working night and day all 5 days, getting people to go out. I'm trying to think. I think the Norway Lodge was involved.
I think Les Gaylord owned it then.
Yeah, Les Gaylord.
I don't think the O'Rears were there yet.
The who?
O'Rears. Finally came in and bought that.
Well, wasn't it the Masons?
Then the Masons came. I don't know whether the Masons were first or O'Rears. But
I think Masons were just after Les Gaylord.
Oh,
then the O'Rears.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then the O'Rears. Yeah, that sounds right. Okay, then we'll go to your career with a 62. Do you remember any?
With what? Oh, 62.
Any interesting stories while driving the Jeeps with any?
But most of that was summer stuff. The only really Jeep. There was one winter when I was still in the. And where the Hoyle River Wash is now, in that little building, that we had something like 62 inches of snow in 3 days, and everyone in the world was stuck. We were the only vehicles that were running. And the reason we were running was I was sending out one 7-passenger limousine with everybody that it could carry to go somewhere, and immediately behind it I was sending a jeep to pull it out of the snowbanks on the way around.
When was this?
This was in early January, as I recall.
Well, it was 56 or 57. Huh?
No, because it was before I had built up on Mill Street.
Oh, even before the jeep lift?
Yeah.
54. Oh.
And then there was...
It wasn't during the FIS. It wasn't the 50s. Besides, you didn't have it then. Okay, it had to be...
51. Well, I built the office up there in 52. I moved in the spring.
Oh.
In the,
I bet it must have been the winter of 53 then.
No, because it was when I was still on Main Street. And I moved in up there on 52. So
it
had to be...
50.
It could have been 51 to 52, that New Year's period.
Yeah, that had to be there, because 1950 was the FIS.
Yeah.
And then you said you moved.
Yeah, in 52 in the spring was when I moved into the office.
Yeah, so it had to be the 51, 52 year.
Yeah.
Oh, that's 62 inches of snow.
Something like that, 16. In one 3-day period, and it was just miserable. And every so often you go around... They didn't plow the side streets, they just plowed the state highways through the middle of town.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the streets survived by being pretty much packed down. Well, come spring in that year, there were so many. I remember one point we turned a corner, probably could have been this corner right down here, you know, in front of the Anderson's house. You turned the corner and the snow had rotted and there was just nothing but china underneath. You'd go down 12, 14 inches with one wheel where it hit a soft spot and just go thud, because the street was way down under all this packs and all.
Yeah.
But
so
everybody's pipes.
You really enjoyed what you said. Your forte was the jeep trips in the summer, which
pretty much the summer jeep trips.
Really,
yeah, that was what I really enjoyed doing.
Oh yeah. And what, a lot of those jeep roads are not open now. What were some of the jeep trips you took to where?
Well, we had a little folder that we put out. We did sedan trips all the way up to Marble, you know, and Independence, Leadville, and Ashcroft. And in the wintertime, we used the jeeps to take people to and from dog sledding in Ashcroft in the winter, all through the taxi route.
Mm-hmm.
Also used them as a school bus one year to get Stewart's kids to school. But the jeep trips in the summertime, we'd take them. Taylor Pass was very popular, a wildflower trip that went up the Midnight Mine Road and came down
the front.
Then we also did an evening steak fry trip, sunset picnic we called it, that we usually went up the front and down through Little Annie to see the lupin, which are just simply marvelous.
Mm.
And we'd stay there, cook steak over charcoal. We took our own little charcoal thing.
Did you happen to do that on what we call Little Annie Picnic Point? Do you know where that is?
Yeah, that's where we used to do it.
Yeah. Okay.
In the summer, pretty much. And watch the sunset.
Mm-hmm.
And then come back and go down the Midnight Mine Road, or go all the way down Little Annie. I think most of the time we went all the way down Little Annie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's two roads there.
Yeah. And come back to town. The reason we took charcoal is there's no water back there. We took along fire extinguishers and everything else, but we were afraid with the little charcoal burner thing, you could roll up the charcoal in foil and totally smother it by the time you left without worrying about fire or anything like that.
Oh, good for you.
But we'd go up to Gold Hill, we'd go up to Lincoln Reservoir and Ruby, and
used
to go up to Pearl Pass to Montezuma Basin,
right.
Montezuma Mine, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Never did get up to the basin except on foot, because the road didn't go that far.
Yeah.
But those were the real popular.
Did you ever go all the way to Crested Butte?
Oh, yes. That was a fall trip. We used to, I had several trips that I took in the fall. Went over Pearl Pass, down to Crested Butte, and then we would go around over Cottonwood Pass, through Tin Cup, come back over Independence.
Yeah, because you end up in little towns called like St. Elmo.
That's right, St. Elmo.
But mm-hmm. that would be via...
it's Cottonwood Pass.
You would have to go...
Taylor Pass.
We would go over either
of several different ways.
There was a
way to go from, now I can't, if I had the maps here I could show you, but I can't tell you by name where they are now. But you would go from Crested Butte and you go down the creek a little ways and you hang a left, as my niece would say, and you would drop over into the Taylor River drainage.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could come back over Taylor Pass if you wanted to, or you go on down and go over Cottonwood Pass into St. Elmo and come back over Independence. We used to make a three-day trip.
And on the same road?
Took the Stranahan family a couple of times on overnights for two, 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
One way we would go over Schofield Pass from Marble,
mm-hmm.
and then back over Pearl, or over Pearl and back over Schofield. Another way,
then
go over Taylor and back over Cottonwood and back in over Independence.
That's a lot of driving. Then you camp overnight too?
We spend 3 days exploring every mine, every hole in the wall, everything that we could find.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In 62, you sold your business
mm-hmm.
to...
Well, Harold Lesh bought it. He couldn't stand the competition with his bus line, so that's why he bought it. Then he jumped the name, and he jumped all the sightseeing, and he just wanted the limousine service to and from Denver and Glenwood.
I see, and so we just...
See, I bought the Glenwood taxi, too, later on.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and we had him coming and going. It was a kind of a disaster in a way, but it gave us the right to pick up anywhere in Pitkin, Garfield, or Eagle County, or in Denver, as long as one end of the trip was Pitkin, Garfield, or Eagle County. And that included Vail, because Vail was in Eagle County.
Right. But Vail wasn't going then yet.
Well, Vail was getting going.
Yeah, what year?
Vail was being built. It was
early 60s. Wasn't it? Okay, so then did you leave Aspen?
No.
No, I went
to work for the Hotel Jerome, and then I worked for 4 years at the Aspen Clinic, and then I didn't go to work at the Hotel Jerome. I went to work at the Meadows, the Aspen Meadows.
Uh-huh.
Desk clerking again. Everything comes full circle.
Right. Oh, 40, 60. So that you
and
started
I was
that
working
now.
At the Aspen Clinic for about 4 years as the business manager for Dr. O'Dane, Dr. Whitcomb, and Dr. Gould. Then I quit that, and I thought, well, I'm tired of working that hard. I want something where I work only in the winter and I can play in the summertime. And I went... I had decided, this was in the early spring, and I had decided that...
So what year, if you worked 4 years, so now we're...
We're 1968, I guess, 66, 67.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Worth had been selling tickets at the number one lift. Ginny Chamberlain was the ticket sales manager at the Ski Corporation. And Ginny, Paul... something happened at the Sundeck, and Paul had to go up there and take over. They had had a couple there who were not a great success, and Paul went up to take care of that. Ginny needed a ticket seller part-time at the number one lift, and since she and I were very good friends, she said, will you go to work for me as a ticket seller up there? You're the only person I can think of that I can bother to try and begin to break in this late in the season. This was in It was just for the month of March and whatever part of April was going on. So I did it. And then in the fall, now I had worked, I went to work for her again in the main ticket office when it was there in the Tom Thumb building.
Mm-hmm.
That was that was several years before. That was before I went to work for the clinic, because I went from there. I had two jobs at once for a while. They had difficulty at the clinic with someone who could operate their posting machine. And I was going in and operating their posting machine when I wasn't working at the ski corporation. So for one winter, I worked with Jenny at the ski corporation. That spring, I went to the clinic. Then I was there for about 4 years, and then Jenny asked me to go up to the number one lift after I had quit them. And then I took the summer off, and then in the fall I went back to work.
What year are we now?
We are now in 66, 67. Mm-hmm. No, 62. 66, 67.
Yeah.
And worked with Jenny in the main ticket office, which was then
the country store building?
The country store building, no, in the back of the country store. And I went to work there with her, and when she retired in 68, I inherited her job. So
as ticket manager.
As ticket manager. The job had several different titles, because there was inflationary price restrictions. You couldn't get a raise unless you got a different job. So I was head ticket seller when I started, and then I got to be manager, ticket sales manager, and then manager of ticket sales, and I don't know, anyhow, it was all the same business.
Right.
But every time I got a raise, I got a different.
And so who was president of the ski company?
Darcy Brown was during my whole era. He left, he retired, what, the year after I did. I retired in the spring of 77.
So you worked as ticket manager, head ticket officer.
Yeah, whatever you call it.
So then about 68 to, what did you say when you retired?
From 68 to 77. Just about 10 years.
About 10 years.
That's about all you could stand of the taking the flak from the public. I understand now that the ticket sales manager is pretty well insulated. Doesn't have to be an adjustment office anymore. You better be a statistician, which I never was any good at anyway.
Right. But it...
kinds of projects. That's when I took up skiing, by the way.
Oh, you did?
I took up skiing after... Well, I took up skiing the year that... when I could get free lessons and everything, because I was working for the ski corporation the winter after I had sold the taxi business, which would have been 63, 64, I think.
Mm-hmm.
62, 63 was at the Meadows, and then 63, 64 was the winter I was with Jenny in the ski corporation office. So it had to be 68 that I went up to the number one lift. But when I was working for the ski corporation that winter, then I got free ski lessons and free lift ticket and the whole business, so then I could take up skiing. And I skied minimally until I went back to work for the ski corporation again.
Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy that?
Oh, yeah. But toward the end, when we had snow mass and everything else going on, I had to ski because there were lifts that you couldn't get to unless you skied down at the bottom of campground.
To distribute the tickets?
Well, you could distribute them, but you couldn't check up. Distribution was easy, but I could get down to campground by riding down on the lift.
Yeah.
You know, the lifts go both ways, but it was rather ridiculous to have them stop at top and bottom to get me on without skis on.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it. If my conscience was clear, if there wasn't anything drastic going on, then I really enjoyed the skiing. But when I was having to ski in order to get there, I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an all-weather person. I'm strictly a fair-weather friend. Which is why I'm now spending the winters in Arizona and the summers in Olympic Springs.
So, okay, so you left the ski company and...
I retired officially, 2 days, well, right after the lift closed in 1977. Clean up the office and got out.
Yeah, and is that when you started going to Aspen, or did you leave Aspen, or you...
No, that's when I left. Well, I had sold my house out at White Horse Springs, and I lived in the backyard of Annalisa Parker up there. They had rented the piece of property up there belonged to the Moores, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my little travel trailer parked in their yard with electric wires running from their house for about a month until the weather cleared up enough so that I could leave.
Mm-hmm.
Spent that summer traveling around and moved into my Arizona home for good that fall. I had owned it for over a year when I moved in it.
You took up golf.
Oh, I took up golf before I left Anne.
Yeah.
Took up golf in the early 70s. 70, 71. Had too many toys. Well, between the horses and the boats and the golf course.
Yeah. When did they have, was there a golf course here?
Yeah.
Golf, I'm trying to remember when they put that golf course.
Oh, that had been here for years before I took up the game of golf. But they rebuilt it the year I left.
Mm-hmm.
That golf course, when I came back in 78,
yeah,
there was no golf course here because they were making an 18-hole golf course.
Yeah, first it was a 9-hole. Yeah. Yeah.
And then it was out of commission for 2 years. If you wanted to play in Aspen, you had to play at Snowmass. A lot of the Aspen girls are going down to West Bank in Glenwood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the story.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Natalie.
You're welcome.
We'll go have lunch. We have one more story to tell about Natalie becoming skier of the week without even putting on skis. When that was in 1954, right?
It was in 1954, after the Jeep lift. I was, Fred and Friedel made me skier of the week, and I believe I'm the only strictly non-skier who was ever made skier of the week. I'm probably the only one of the few people you ever meet who ever lived 15 years in Aspen without putting on skis.
Oh, yeah, we had to record that for sure. Okay, thanks, Natalie. Another story that Natalie told me about the Gary Cooper family, when they arrived in Glenwood, via the train, she went down to pick him up in her taxi, drove back just as they went across the Hunter Creek Bridge. Natalie had a flat tire. They got out and
it was just for the month of March and whatever part of April was going on. So I did it. And then in the fall, now I had worked, the fall I went to work for her again in the main ticket office when it was there in the Tom Thumb building.
Mm-hmm.
Several years before, that was before I went to work for the clinic, because I went from there, I had two jobs at once for a while. They had difficulty at the clinic with someone who could operate their posting machine. And so I was going in and operating their posting machine when I wasn't working at the ski corporation. So for one winter, I worked with Ginny at the ski corporation. That spring, I went to the clinic. Then I was there for about 4 years, and then Ginny asked me to go up to the number one lift after I had quit them. And then I took the summer off, and then in the fall, I went back to work.
What year are we now?
We are now in 66, 67.
Yeah.
And worked with Ginny in the main ticket office, which was then...
the country store building?
The country store building, no, in the back of the country store. And went to work there with her, and when she retired in 68, I inherited her job. So
as ticket manager.
The job had several different titles because there was inflationary price restrictions. You couldn't get a raise unless you got a different job. So I was head ticket seller when I started, and then I got to be manager, ticket sales manager, and then manager of ticket sales, and I don't know, anyhow, it was all the same business.
Right.
But every time I got a raise, I got a different...
And so who was president of the ski company?
Darcy Brown was during my whole era. He retired, what, the year after I did. I retired in the spring of 77. That was my last year on the job.
So you worked as ticket manager, head ticket officer.
Yeah, whatever you call it.
So then about 68 to, what did you say when you retired?
From 68 to 77, just about 10 years.
About 10 years.
Yeah. It was, that's about all you could stand of the taking the flak from the public. I understand now that the ticket sales manager is pretty well insulated, doesn't have to be an adjustment office anymore. It says you better be a statistician, which I never was any good at anyway.
All right. But it...
kinds of projects. That's when I took up skiing, by the way.
Oh, you did?
I took up skiing after... Well, I took up skiing the year that... when I could get free lessons and everything, because I was working for the ski corporation that the winter after I had sold the taxi business, which would have been 63, 64, I think.
Mm-hmm.
62, 63 was at the Meadows, and then 63, 64 was the winter I was with Ginny in the ski corporation office. So it had to be 68 that I went up to the number one list. But when I was working for the ski corporation that winter, then I got free ski lessons and free lift ticket and the whole business, so then I could take up skiing. And I skied minimally until I went back to work for the ski corporation again.
Mm-hmm. And well, did you enjoy that?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But toward the end, when we had snow mass and everything else going on, I had to ski because there were lifts that you couldn't get to unless you skied down at the bottom of the campground. And
to distribute
that business
tickets.
Well, you could distribute them, but you couldn't check up. Distribution was easy, but I could get down to campground by riding down on the lift.
Yeah.
You know, the lifts go both ways, but it was rather ridiculous to have them stop at top and bottom to get me on without skis on.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it.
Uh-huh.
If my conscience was clear, if there wasn't anything drastic going on, then I really enjoyed the skiing. But when I was having to ski in order to get there, I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an all-weather person. I'm strictly a fair-weather friend. Which is why I'm now spending the winters in Arizona and the summers in Olympic
right.
Springs.
So, okay. So you left the ski company and...
I retired officially, 2 days... Well, right after the lift closed in 1977. Clean up the office and got out.
Yeah, and is that when you started going to Aspen, or did you leave Aspen, or you?
No, that's when I left. Well, I had sold my house out at Whitehorse Springs, and I lived in the backyard of Annalisa Parker up there. They had rented the piece of property up there belonged to the Moores, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my little travel trailer parked in their yard with electric wires running from their house. For about a month until the weather cleared up enough so that I could leave.
Mm-hmm.
Spent that summer traveling around and moved into my Arizona home for good that fall. I had owned it for over a year when I moved in it.
You took up golf.
Oh, I took up golf before I left Aspen.
Yeah.
I took up golf in the early 70s, 70, 71. Had too many toys.
Well,
the horses and the boats and the golf course.
Yeah. When did they have, was there a golf course here?
Yeah.
Golf, I remember when they put that golf course.
Oh, that had been here for years before I took up the game of golf, but they rebuilt it the year I left.
Mm-hmm.
That golf course, when I came back in 78, there was no golf course here because they were making an 18-hole golf course.
Yeah, first it was a 9-hole.
Yeah. And then it was out of commission for 2 years. If you wanted to play in Aspen, you had to play at Snowmass. A lot of the Aspen girls are going down to West Bank in Glenwood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the story.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Natalie.
You're welcome.
We'll go have lunch. We have one more story to tell about Natalie becoming skier of the week without even putting on skis. When that was in 1954, right?
It was in 1954, after the Jeep lift. Fred and Friedel made me skier of the week, and I believe I'm the only strictly non-skier who was ever made skier of the week. I'm probably the only one of the few people you ever meet who ever lived 15 years in Aspen without putting on skis.
Oh, yeah, we had to record that for sure. Okay, thanks, Natalie.
Another story that Natalie told me about the Gary Cooper family, when they arrived in Glenwood via the train, she went down to pick them up in her taxi, drove back just as they went across the Hunter Creek Bridge. Natalie had a flat tire. They got out, and